In today's lecture, we're going to talk about the classical limit of quantum theory. It is an important topic for properly understanding how interpretations of quantum mechanics work. I have to say, out of all the topics that I'm talking about in this course, it's the one that I'm least familiar with. So I've never done any research on it, so I spent the last couple of weeks trying to get my head straight on it. So this is the first time I've lectured on this. So if there are things where it's not clear, it's probably because I'm not clear myself about it. So I do appreciate if you have comments and questions during the lecture. Hopefully it'll improve my understanding. I have to say I have actually had nightmares about the classical limit of quantum mechanics in the last 2 weeks. Thinking about it too much. Okay, so what I'm going to try and do is give a version of what I think is basically the standard story of how this works, although it is one of those topics that's sort of controversial. If you read a bunch of papers about it, you'll see different contradictory statements made. So here's how it's going to go. Last time I started talking about requirements for the classical limit, I'm going to briefly review that again. Then we will talk about what you can do basically with just bare quantum mechanics, unitary evolution of quantum mechanics. That's these three sections here. And then we'll talk about the important topic of environmentally induced decoherence, which does get referenced a lot when we move on to talk about interpretations of quantum theory. Okay, so if you remember from last time, I outlined three different requirements that we have in the classical limit. We want the disappearance of typical quantum phenomena, actualization of measurement outcomes, and to recover the equations of classical mechanics. So briefly, disappearance of quantum phenomena says that you shouldn't be able to observe quantum interference between, say, a massive particle in the between states of a massive particle in the classical limit. Of course, in the classical limit of electromagnetic fields, we do still want to maintain interference. So when you have a large number of photons, then you expect the interference phenomena that you observe in classical optics to be derivable from quantum mechanics. The incompatibility of observables, we should basically be able to measure all observables at the same time classically. And phenomena like contextuality and non-locality disappear. Right, so taken together, this says that you should basically have a model for your experiments that in the classical limit that you can describe by classical probability theory. Right, we don't have to sum probability amplitudes of different possible states. We should be able to just talk about probabilities of being in this state or that state. Then we have to solve the problem of the actualization of measurement outcomes. This is what we're going to end up talking a lot about in interpretations. So if we've solved this problem, then we've got at least a formal model in terms of classical probabilities of things that are in the classical limit. But we don't yet know that these probabilities can be interpreted in the usual classical way, right? So even if you've got a situation in which, you know, your cat is either you've got cat alive, cat dead equal to a half, and you know that you've got rid of any ability to perform interference experiments between those two branches, how do we know that that really describes a situation in which either the cat is dead or it is alive, right? Because quantum mechanics isn't going to tell us that. It could still be that it's in some kind of indefinite state until you actually observe it, and you can't solve that without saying what the ontology is, what exists in reality. That's definitely interpretation dependent, and then we have to be able to recover the equations of classical mechanics, but there's multiple formalisms for classical mechanics, and importantly, we can talk about the classical mechanics of a probability density in phase space. So probability density is an object describing our uncertainty about the classical point on phase space. and it evolves according to the Liouville equation here. But there's also the idea of the trajectory limit, where we can really track the position and momentum of an individual particle exactly through phase space, obeying Hamilton's equations. Okay, so by the way, if you have this, then you have this, right? Because you get the Liouville equation by considering an ensemble of trajectories with different possible initial starting conditions. But just because you can derive this doesn't mean that you have that. Because you have this probability density evolving in time, you don't really know that the state of reality doesn't jump around between different points in that probability density. So you don't know that you've got a classical trajectory necessarily. Okay, so as I said last time, which of these limits you consider the most important, or you think that we have to solve in an interpretation-independent manner, will depend on your view of what the quantum state is. Right, so if you have a psi-complete theory, all there is a unitarily evolving wave function, then we have to get classical trajectories somehow, and that's the only thing we've got, right? That's the only thing that we've said exists. So because we do observe classical systems traveling along definite trajectories, and you say this is the only thing that exists, we need to derive this from unitary evolution of the quantum state. In a psi epistemic theory, on the other hand, we commonly make the analogy between the quantum state and a probability distribution, right? So in a psi epistemic theory, if you're going to want to think of the classical trajectories as being real, as being the real things, quantum state isn't a real thing, right? It doesn't make much sense to try and derive the real trajectories just in terms of an evolving thing that you think represents a state of knowledge. You would expect to be able to get the Liouville limit, but whatever travels along the trajectories is not considered part of quantum theory, yeah.
Why can't you say the same thing for the psi-complete theory? Why can't you also say that there isn't anything real traveling along trajectories?
Because we see, at least for certain systems, you see them traveling along definite trajectories. If I take a harmonic oscillator, a classical harmonic oscillator, can track its position and momentum in time. That's a physical system that we can observe. According to a psi-complete theory, that emerges somehow from the unitary evolution of the wave function.
So how does the psi-epistemic theory explain that you observe trajectories?
Well, it depends. So if you're a realist psi-epistemic theory, something along the lines of Speckens toy theory, then you will say that the quantum state is like a probability distribution, but there are some underlying degrees of freedom, and those are going to have to have trajectories emerge. But since we don't know what those are, we can't expect to derive it in a theory-independent way. Now, if you're an anti-realist psi-epistemicist, something more like Copenhagenism, you're going to say something like, it's our observations that force things onto a definite trajectory. So I'm not endorsing that point of view, but you know, in a sort of Copenhagen type view, nothing's really actualized until you look at it, right? So you have to consider that the reason why a harmonic oscillator travels along a definite trajectory is because it's repeatedly being observed by some observer. yeah, and then I said, well, in other cases, in the psiontic but not psi-complete interpretation, it's completely non-obvious. So usually, the additional variables that we add in, like positions in Bohmian mechanics, those are the things that things are supposed to be made out of. Those are obviously going to have to obey classical trajectories, but the wave function itself, what does it have to do? Does it have to look like a Liouville distribution? Does it have to look does it have to have anything to do with trajectories? It's not obvious until we look at the details of the interpretation in that case. So part of the reason for the confusion about the classical limit, I think, is this. People are trying to do different things, and they have different requirements for what classical limit should look like. All right, let's make an important caveat here. In physics, there are some very straightforward limits and more complicated ones. So if we consider the Newtonian limit of special relativity, it's really straightforward. If I take any particle that's traveling with velocity a lot smaller than the speed of light, then I can replace the Lorentz transformations with the Galilei transformations to very high accuracy. I'll have the standard classical equations for kinetic energy and so forth. Then that's very straightforward. So any particle that's traveling with a relatively low velocity, we can say is Newtonian in that case. However, in quantum mechanics, it isn't really the case that as soon as a system has n particles, as soon as a system has 5,000 particles, you can treat it as effectively classical. When we carefully, in the lab, we can carefully engineer mesoscopic quantum systems, right? So right now in Vienna, they've done double slit experiment with a virus, right? Quantum double slit experiment with a virus. It's quite, it has dozens of atoms, right? So we can engineer in carefully controlled environments, large quantum systems to display quantum effects. And we expect, most physicists seem to expect that we can extend this to arbitrarily macroscopic systems. Well, if you are trying to build a quantum computer, then you're going to have coherent superpositions of millions of quantum particles, right, ultimately, if you think that's possible. We think that's possible, right? So you can't expect to attain the classical limit in general. We'll only expect to attain the classical limit for quantum states and Hamiltonians, that are the ones which are typically found in nature, and only with high probability, right? If we believe quantum mechanics, then there is a tiny, tiny probability of me tunneling outside this room, exponentially small, but it's there, right? So we expect to find the classical limit with high probability and only for sort of natural quantum states, initial states, and Hamiltonians that are found in nature. So in this respect, it's more like the derivation of thermodynamics from statistical mechanics. I think this is a pretty good analogy. If you understand how that works, of course, this is also limits that are like this generate a huge controversy in foundations of physics literature. So that's also a controversy. But in statistical mechanics, you can always find initial states that don't obey the second law, right? They're usually measure zero sets or whatever. But it's only typical kinds of initial states that give rise to second law, only if your dynamics is sufficiently mixing, right? If you have a dynamics which doesn't interact particles, your system with a heat bath at all, then it won't obey the second law. And you only derive it with high probability. Similarly, right? There's a small chance that all the air molecules in this room will go to that corner. It will take longer than the lifetime of the universe for that to happen, but it exists. So this is the same kind of limit. All right, so, and one of the things that we know about these kinds of limits is that we usually need some notion of coarse graining to make it work, right? So in statistical mechanics, if I were to track the microstate of the system exactly, then I don't see its entropy increase, right? It's only because we only have access to coarse-grained information that I lose the predictability of what my system's going to do. So this is going to be the same idea here at the end, anyway. All right, so now I'm going to talk about Wigner-Moyle formalism. What's the point of doing this? Okay, well, first of all, classical mechanics and quantum mechanics are formulated in different mathematical languages, right? So classical mechanics is formulated on a phase space, at least in the Hamiltonian version, whereas quantum theory is formulated in Hilbert space. So I need to find a common mathematical language that includes both of them so that I can say when this reduces to that, okay? So there are multiple ways that you can do this. You can try and formulate classical mechanics in Hilbert space, or you can try and come up with some more general mathematical structure that includes both of them. But a relatively straightforward thing to do is to formulate a version of quantum theory that lives in phase space. And this will give us what's called the Wigner-Moyle formalism. So for simplicity here, I'm just going to focus on the case of a single particle in one dimension without spin. We can extend these ideas to more general phase spaces without without too much trouble, but just to get conceptually what's going on. Okay, so the first thing we have to do is somehow, okay, so we have a quantum state. If we have a continuous degree of freedom, so position of a particle, the Hilbert space is the square integrable functions of x. So the density operator is an operator on that space, right? So we need to convert such a thing into a function on phase space, which is somehow analogous to a probability density. Okay, so how are we going to do this? Well, there's a general way of doing it, which is called pseudo-probability densities. What we do is to each point in phase space, we associate a Hermitian operator, which is called a phase point operator. Then you can define your function to be the trace of this operator against rho. Now, this is a Hermitian operator, so what this will do is it will convert, well, it's a Hermitian operator, so this is the formula for an expectation value. So it's going to give you a number, a real number. But I haven't said it's a positive operator, so this number might be negative. Okay, so bear that in mind, that's important. Now, let's choose these operators to be complete. In some cases, you choose them to be overcomplete. I'm not going to consider that case because we don't need it here. In this sense, so if I integrate these operators over all of phase space, they give me the identity. What will that do? Well, if I integrate this over all of phase space, then I can take the integral inside here. This will give me the identity, then I'll get trace of the density operator, which is 1. So this tells me that the probability density, the pseudo-probability density, is normalized in the same way that the probability density usually is, right? So it's when I integrate over all the degrees of freedom, I get 1. Okay, the only difference is it can take negative values. Okay, so now let's consider further specialized. Let's imagine that these are actually orthogonal, right? I'm not going to say orthonormal because one always when you're using the Hilbert-Schmidt inner product, this is the Hilbert-Schmidt inner product of operators, you always have issues with where you should put the normalization. so I'm going to allow there to be a normalization constant here, okay? Because otherwise you may get to run into trouble with also having this. So I'm going to allow them to be, they're going to be orthogonal. And that means that we can recover the density operator, right? So basically, if these are basically forming an orthonormal basis of operators, so what this says is that this is the coefficient of that operator. So here, rho has to have these coefficients with these operators, and this factor 1 over n occurs here because I've allowed this normalization. Okay, so that's just usual inner products give you coefficients. So I can go back to the density operator easily. So now let's consider an observable self-adjoint operator. This you want to become a function on phase space. Classically, observables or physical quantities are functions on phase space. So I'm going to define in the same way just this, although I'm going to put the normalization factor in here for the reason that you're about to see. So if I put the normalization factor on this part, then I don't get it on the recovery formula. Right, but otherwise it's the same. And then, what does this mean? Well, let's consider the expectation value of that observable. Now, what I can do is I can expand both of these, both m and rho, in this operator basis. Right? These are now just numbers, so they come out of the trace, and I just get the trace here. But this trace is satisfies this orthogonality condition, so I'm going to lose the normalization factor and I get delta functions in x and p. So I just get this formula, and this is exactly the formula you would expect in classical probability for the expectation value of an observable with respect to a probability density. Right, so the formula for taking expectation values is going to be the same as in classical probability. Any questions so far? No? Okay. Now, this is where it gets complicated. Now let's look at time evolution. Time evolution of the density operator under a Hamiltonian is given by von Neumann's equation here. This comes from the Schrödinger equation applied at the level of density operators. So if I want to know how does this probability, pseudo-probability density evolve in time, then I have to take the trace of this against the phase point operators, like this. But now, I will also insert into here the decomposition of the Hamiltonian, like this, and the decomposition of the state, like this. And then you'll get a formula like this, and this formula is going to, so here, I have a commutator, right? So all the numerical coefficients come out the front, but I get this commutator, and I've got products of three of these operators. So just because I know that they're orthogonal doesn't mean I know anything about the trace of three products of three operators. So there's a sort of formal way to handle this, which is let's define a kind of product of functions like this, okay? So the idea is we put the triple product in here. It's not supposed to be a comma there. It's just a straight triple product of these three operators. And then in order to get the commutator to appear in here, we'll define something called the Moyal bracket, which is to just basically the commutator with respect to this product. So these functions, these are just classical functions. So they commute with the regular product, but we engineer a new product which sort of mimics what goes on in quantum mechanics. Okay, so then with that, we can rewrite this whole horrible equation as just the time evolution is the Moyal bracket of the function representative of the Hamiltonian with the pseudo-probability density. So this is formally now looks analogous to the Liouville equation, right? The difference is that here we have this pseudo-probability density that can go negative, and this is the Poisson bracket, whereas this is the Moyal bracket. All right. So there's a lot of mass throwing at you, but let's proceed. Okay, so now, so that's a fairly general framework. I can make many, many choices and that would all work. Let's choose some particular phase point operators. The particular choice of phase point operators is this one. And I'm not gonna go into too much detail about where they come from, just once you play with them for a while, you see it's quite a nice choice. They obey this orthogonality where this is the normalization factor here. And so I can, right, so when I take the trace of this against rho, we know that the trace, I can bring this round and write it like this, okay? So this is the Wigner function of a given density operator. So here are just some examples of what they look like. Here, I've taken the energy eigenstates of a harmonic oscillator. This is the zero eigenstate, so no excitation to one and five, then equals five state. And as you can see, the ground state is nice. It looks like a Gaussian, it is a Gaussian probability density, right? So it's not negative or anything. As soon as I go to higher energy levels, I get negative values and I get these sort of wavy patterns, which is sort of characteristic of quantum interference. And so these are, in some sense, very far away from being classical. Okay, so that's what they look like. Where does the Wigner function come from? I'm not gonna, so you can write down a list of natural criteria that you want one of these pseudo-probabilities to satisfy, which would uniquely give you those Wigner functions. So Wigner did that in the 1970s. But I'll just mention a couple of its properties. One is, well, you usually want your pseudo-probability distributions to give you the correct marginal probabilities. So if I marginalize over x, I should get the probability distribution that quantum mechanics predicts for momentum. And similarly, if I marginalize over momentum, I should get the probability distribution that quantum mechanics predicts for position, and these give you that. And the other thing is Galilean invariance. So here I'm saying if I take my quantum state and I shift it along the x direction, if I perform a shift operation in the x direction, then I expect that my pseudo-probability density just also shifts in the x direction. This is really saying that the phase point operators treat every point of phase space in the same, in an equal way. So similarly, if I do a momentum shift, then it should shift in momentum in the same way. Okay. But you need a few more conditions than this to uniquely give you those phase point operators. All right, so now, and I'm not going to do this because there's a lot of mathematics behind this that I don't have time to do in detail. You can take your Moyal bracket and now expand it as a formal power series in H-bar. You'll notice that in this section of the course, I've reintroduced H-bar because obviously classical effects are supposed to be large compared to H-bar, so it's useful to have it back. If you do that, you find that the Moyal bracket can be written, the lowest order term is just the Poisson bracket, and then you get terms of order H-bar squared. So it kind of looks like we've succeeded. It looks like we have some sort of alluvial limit. It says that the quantum corrections to the alluvial equation of order H-bar squared. But there's an important there are important caveats to that. you can also derive the corresponding equation for observables, right? So like in quantum mechanics, we can talk about observing, in quantum mechanics, you can have the Schrodinger picture where you evolve the quantum state, or the Heisenberg picture where you evolve the observables. And do the same thing here, and we get basically the Hamilton's equation for the observables, as you would expect, again, up to terms of order h-bar squared. Okay, so is that the classical limit? Well, first of all, note that if this is the classical limit, it's only a alluvial limit, not a trajectory limit. Note that we haven't really derived it, though, because even though we've got Liouville's equation here, you may still have that this is negative, which is highly non-classical. So I haven't derived the positivity of that Wigner function. And it's also true that not all the observables, when we do the correspondence between quantum observables and these guys, this is only going to be the classical limit if those observables are what you expect them to be, right? So there's no guarantee that if I write down some function of position and momentum, that tracing with the phase point operator gives me that same function back. So it does in some cases. So if M happens to be vial ordered polynomial, it just means that for every monomial, I write it in all possible orders, right, like this. Then you get what you expect, right? So these are all, in some sense, quantum representations of x squared p, and when you have a vial ordered observable like this, you do indeed get what you expect. But not every quantum observable does that. So this one on its own, for instance, does give you that, plus a very complicated integral, which I wasn't able to do in the time in the time I had to prepare this lecture. But it involves Fourier transforms and things that are not particularly easy to take Fourier transforms. So not all observables do, and obviously in quantum mechanics, we can measure these observables, and so they will give us something that doesn't easily correspond to a classical limit. Okay. So let's now consider, well, an example where we actually get an exact alluvial limit. So in this case, it turns out that this order h-bar squared term is zero in this equation. So let's just consider a free particle that's in some Gaussian state like this. Okay, probability density of x and p are Gaussians, and if you calculate the Wigner function, you get exactly what you would expect, right? So here I just have a product of a Gaussian in X and a Gaussian in P. And if we look at the standard deviations, this guy's the standard deviation of x. Standard deviation of x is sigma, but here I've got the sigma on top, so I have to take the square root and invert that. So the uncertainty in P is h bar over 2 sigma, and this is a state that saturates the uncertainty principle, the minimum uncertainty state. So if anything was going to have a trajectory limit, a state with minimum uncertainty you would expect to, but of course that we know that free particles spread. So this is an example. The diagrams here are in units where h bar is 1. So I plotted these the other day. This is a minimum uncertainty state. I've set equal position and momentum uncertainty. And I just evolve this thing for, almost a second. I evolved it for exactly a second, by the way. It just became a straight line, so that's why I had to stop there. And you see it spreads. And there's correlations develop between the position and the momentum, as you would expect, because if you started out initially with a higher momentum, then you're going to end up at a further position, right? But this thing spreads. This is exactly what the Liouville equation tells you will happen for this initial state, classically. So we get to Liouville limits, fine as a Liouville limit, but it's obviously not fine as a trajectory limit, right? If you want to think of this as somehow representing a localized particle, it quickly becomes delocalized. Okay, so, however, we can make a very general statement about when you get to Liouville limit. So generally, it's the case that if you consider what's called Gaussian quantum mechanics, you get exactly the Liouville limit. So what does this mean? It means, so this is on an arbitrary phase space. If your states have Gaussian distributions as their Wigner functions, any Gaussian distribution, so quadratic, basically in x and p in the exponent, if your Hamiltonians preserve that Gaussianity, so it means it maps Gaussian states to Gaussian states, and you can determine that Hamiltonians that do that are basically at most, those y's should be p's, sorry. I don't know why I switched to y, too. Preparing this too late at night. If they're at most quadratic in the canonical variables x and p, okay, so those should be p's. And then it turns out, so then you impose that you can only do measurements that are, are going to preserve the Gaussianity of the states. And it turns out that the POVM elements are then the ones that are also represented by Gaussian functions, so exponentials with a quadratic in the exponent. Then you find that the Wigner-Moyal formalism is identical to the Liouville equation for those cases. You can see a proof in here. This is a little bit like the Spekenstoy theory, except for continuous variables. But it's not going to give you a trajectory limit. And it's only for that restricted class of Hamiltonians. Okay. Right. So how are we going to get a trajectory limit? Well, you want to have wave functions which have wave packets which have minimal uncertainty in both position and momentum. You would like the centroids of those wave packets to obey Hamilton mechanics, and you want them to not spread over time. A lot of requirements. Wave packets that do this are generally called coherent states, but they only exist for a limited class of Hamiltonians, more restrictive than even this. Some Hamiltonians have them though. Okay, so an example is the harmonic oscillator. So if we consider the harmonic oscillator Hamiltonian, then we can define a coherent state as an eigenstate of the lowering operator. So alpha here is the eigenvalue of the lowering operator. The lowering operator is not Hermitian, so its eigenvalues are going to be complex. And if I write this eigenvalue, this is mimicking how you define the lowering operator in terms of the x and p operators. So these are just numbers here, right? So if I write this eigenvalue in terms of its real and imaginary parts like this, then we can identify these complex values alpha with points in phase space. And As you might expect, these are wave packets which have their centroids at those points. So how do they look like? So you start with this equation, and you know how to represent the lowering operator in terms of x and p. So start with that equation, and you can write down the quantum state, the wave function that corresponds to that, then we can convert it to a Wigner function. And the Wigner functions look exactly like this. They are centered at big X and big P, right, point in phase space, and they're, again, just a product of Gaussians. So it's a Gaussian centered at X and P, and if we look at these coefficients, here are the uncertainties, and again, it's a minimal uncertainty state. So in some sense, this distributes the uncertainty equally between position and momentum, because you can sort of think of these as the unit conversion factor between the two, like position and momentum are in different units. More importantly, what you find is now you look at the equation of motion of this thing, and you find that it maintains its form over time, the uncertainties don't change, and the centroid obeys the classical equations of motion. So it goes around in a circle in phase space like a harmonic oscillator. Right, so there's an example that I stole from Wikipedia, right? So this is a wave packet. You can sort of think about it as, you know, these uncertainties are going to be of the order h bar, right? So it's what it's doing in phase space really looks like a trajectory of a classical particle. Okay. So let's say something about coherent states in general, because they're important for the electromagnetic field in particular. So most bosonic fields in nature have approximate coherent states, which means I may need to neglect some interaction effects to get this. So if you consider the electromagnetic field, if we ignore photon-photon interactions, which, you know, in quantum field theory come from photons generating an electron and then electron-positron pair and then decaying back to photons. These interactions are of the order of the coupling constant to the power 4, so they're quite small. In that case, you've got no photon-photon interactions. The electromagnetic field has coherent states that are approximately localized around specific values of the electromagnetic and magnetic field. And just like X and P we found obey the classical equations of motion, you will find that these will obey the free field Maxwell equations. Of course, if there are sources, then this is not going to give a good trajectory limit, because if the photon was to scatter off an electron, it will get entangled with the electron, and then we have a highly non-classical kind of state. But we can take this as a model of coherent light, so a laser beam or something like that, traveling in free space. Okay, so that is. Forms part of the classical limit, definitely, because we do see in classical optics those kinds of effects. All right, and this is relevant in particular because photons really interact very little in free space. Okay, so they somehow still behave more or less like isolated quantum systems, but we still have to be able to treat them classically. All right, so that's, I'm not going to go into details of that. So let's have a look at the summary so far. So Gaussian quantum mechanics, if we stick to that, we have a good Liouville limit. If we restrict even further, we have coherent states that have a trajectory limit for even more restricted class of Hamiltonian. But both of these are severe restrictions on the class of states of Hamiltonians we can deal with. As soon as we introduce interactions, electromagnetic field is no longer going to give you a quadratic Hamiltonian, and so you're out of this situation. And even if I take a superposition of two Gaussian states, so if I think of a particle in one of two locations, so two wave packets well localized in phase space, take a superposition of them, that has negative Wigner function. Furthermore, if we want a trajectory limit, we can't even have all of this because we have spreading in phase space. So So we have to deal with these issues. We have to get rid of the negativity in the Wigner function. We have to be able to deal with non-Gaussian states. And we have to deal with spreading if we want a trajectory limit. Okay, so let me just give you an example of this. This is a kind of a Schrodinger's cat state of a harmonic oscillator. What I've taken is a superposition of two coherent states, a certain distance apart. They start a certain distance apart in space with roughly the same momentum. And then they both circulate in space, but the superposition gives me this sort of pattern in the middle here, and these blue parts are where the Wigner function goes negative. And this is because as these two wave packets go backwards and forwards in the quadratic potential, in the harmonic oscillator potential, when they start overlapping with each other in position, as you can see down here, when they overlap in position, they interfere. And this term in the middle is responsible for that interference effect. Similarly, they also interfere in momentum space. Now, you can derive that if I move these coherent states further apart, or if I make my potential weaker, right? So it's easier to move these two further apart, the interference effect in the middle goes down. But you know, if I have that superposition of coherent states, I can always move them closer together, and I can always see that interference somehow, basically by some dynamics. Okay, so if we want to think of this as like a Schrodinger's cat state, what we'd really like is this bit in the middle to disappear, so that we could view it as just a mixture of two classical probability distributions. So we haven't managed to do that yet. Okay, so now in 15 minutes, I'm going to try and tell the story of, yeah, we can probably get through it. Yeah. I'm going to tell the story of environmentally induced decoherence. Okay. So now suppose we have a system that's in a superposition of two states. Let's think of them as macroscopically distinct. Typically, they'll only be approximately orthogonal, right? So if I have a very massive particle in a Gaussian state over here, centered over here, and a Gaussian state centered over there, there's still some overlap between those wave functions. But for the purposes of this, of telling you what the basic idea is, I'm going to assume that these are basically orthogonal. So you could have, you know, that this represents an alive cat or a dead cat or a large object at two different locations or something like that. Now the point is that, so if I just have this raw state here, then you will see interference effects like this. Okay. But the point is that systems are interacting with their environment all the time. So for example, photons and air molecules are scattering off things in the world all the time, quite rapidly. So it's interacting with its environment. So let's consider a particle that's scattering off of this system. So let's suppose it's initially uncorrelated, so chi zero is the initial state of the environment here, of the photon that's scattering off it, let's say. And then let's say that the scattered particle gets correlated, not necessarily a lot, right? So one photon that scatters off my face doesn't necessarily contain a lot of information about the position of my head, right? But it contains a little bit of information. So it gets correlated with the system, and that interaction hardly perturbs the system, right? So if I'm a big, massive object, then a photon bouncing off me isn't going to do much to my state. So at least approximately, we can say that this system gets correlated with some state of the environment, but the two states aren't necessarily orthogonal, right? So if we're talking about photons bouncing off me, depending on how different these two states are, it may be pretty much the same state. But this will be less than one, but not necessarily orthogonal. Okay. So after one scattering event, we'd have this. And if we can now compute the reduced density operator of the system, we find that we have these diagonal terms in this basis, mod alpha squared, mod beta squared. And we have off-diagonal terms. And these off-diagonal terms depend on the inner product between these two states. Now, if we have n photons or n particles that scatter in the same kind of way, then we'll have a tensor product of n copies of these states at the end. And then if I take the reduced density operator, the off-diagonal components will have this factor, which is the inner product to the power n. Okay. So let's suppose the average time between these scattering events is tau. Then after a time t, there'll be roughly t over tau such events. So if I look at one of these off-diagonal elements and look at this, look at the modulus of it, the off-diagonal elements are going to scale like this, okay? So this, because this is a number between 0 and 1, this is decreasing exponentially in time, okay? So for a sufficiently long time, these components will decay away and we'll just be left with a mixture. So it will be indistinguishable. So if I now do an experiment on the system alone, the environment's lost, I won't be able to distinguish it from a mixture. And the time scale on which this happens is usually extremely short. I don't have time to go into the details of decoherence times and so forth. Okay, so that's roughly the idea. So if we go back to here, this interference term part here is due to the superposition between these two. If it interacts with the environment, the off-diagonal terms will get killed and we'll just be left with a mixture of two things that can be interpreted classically. That's the basic idea. All right, so now let's just have a look at what the general framework for decoherence is. So I have a system which is described by some Hilbert space and an environment also described by Hilbert space. We've got the tensor product of the two. The total Hamiltonian of the whole thing is some internal Hamiltonian of the system, some internal Hamiltonian of the environment, plus an interaction term. Now, a pointer state, okay, so I should probably explain the terminology here. In many treatments of this, you treat the system and measuring device as one system and then the environment. So these are called pointer states because we're thinking of them as states in which the measurement device is pointing to a definite value. But it's one that's basically robust to decoherence, right? So we consider a pointer state to be one that doesn't get entangled with the environment during the course of this evolution. So in the case of this interaction that we had here, if I started out with one of these two states, alpha and beta, one of alpha and beta is zero, then it doesn't get entangled. Those will be the pointer states in that case. They're really the states that the environment is carrying away information about. Okay. So, and note that in general, I can allow pointer states to depend on time because, well, going back to this diagram again, I would really like this guy to be a pointer state and that guy to be a pointer state. Those evolve in time. Okay. But the important thing is that they don't get entangled with the environment. And a sufficient condition for that, actually it's quite complicated, the full conditions for this, but a sufficient condition for this is that if you have a state that commutes with the interaction Hamiltonian, and it doesn't get correlated with the environment, and this was proposed by Zurek, sometimes called his commutation condition, okay? Right, so, however, the problem is that there might not be any pointer states because there might not be any exact pointer states because, you know, the system is evolving as well during the course of this, right? So you might have something which commutes with the interaction Hamiltonian, but it gets moved away by the system. You get system Hamiltonian quickly so that the correlations develop. So normally, we don't demand exact pointer states, but we demand only that we have approximate pointer states. So we choose some epsilon, and we make these approximately uncorrelated with the environment. So these kind of states don't get entangled very much with the environment. Maybe they develop a small amount of correlation, but not very much. So, you know, everything in decoherence is approximate. So remember, even when we go back to this model, it's never the case that this is exactly this. I need infinite photons to scatter off for that to happen. But it's approximately, it will be, to within experimental precision, it will be indistinguishable. The same idea here. Okay, so now let's look at what happens here. So there's some limits which are typically discussed, right? So we can consider, so the frequencies that the Hamiltonian, so the energy gaps in the Hamiltonian determine how fast the evolution is, right? Because you get the evolution by the Schrodinger equation is an eigenstate evolves like E minus E. Right. So the larger the energy gaps in your Hamiltonian, because it's only relative phases that matter, the larger the energy gap in your Hamiltonian, the faster the evolution is. So if the typical time scale for the interaction Hamiltonian is large compared with the system, we can effectively imagine that the system isn't evolving. And if you look at this sort of stereotypical type of interaction, then in this case, the pointer states will be eigenstates of just this operator here. So we can think of this interaction as basically measuring the observable AS. If we start with an initial state that's a superposition, the reduced density operator will be approximately diagonal in that basis after a short time. So this is kind of what happens if you do the stereotypical von Neumann type of measurement, which was on homework number, the measurement question. Which one was that?
Yeah, homework.
Homework two, right, yeah, that kind of interaction. We'll do this. Right, okay. So the other limit that's considered is where the interaction, the energy gap in the interaction is small compared with the system. Then, and this is a little bit of a tricky limit to deal with, but then the pointer states tend to be eigenstates of the system Hamiltonian, energy eigenstates. And that explains why throughout all of undergraduate quantum mechanics, you treated the hydrogen atom as if it was somehow always in an energy eigenstate. Because for microscopic systems, this is true. All right, but none of these are the interesting regime. This is the interesting regime is the one that's like, so what I'm about to tell you isn't universally true, but it's true for a large class of models that have been studied in the literature. The mathematics is pretty complicated. What's interesting is the intermediate regime. So in this intermediate regime, we've got a competition between the system Hamiltonian and the interaction Hamiltonian, and exact pointer states don't usually exist. But actually, for the typical interactions we find in nature, what we find is that the coherent states are approximate pointer states. So what does that mean? This is our Schrodinger cat state, the one that I actually, okay, going back again, we'll put this up again, this state, right? It's a superposition of two coherent states. What that means is that in this kind of intermediate limit, we expect that, we expect that this Schrodinger cat state would actually evolve under decoherence to a mixture. And that would get rid of those interference terms in the Wigner function. So the negativity in the Wigner function would disappear, and the evolution would look just like a mixture of two Gaussians under Liouville dynamics. Again, you know, this is a story I'm telling you because we don't have time to go through the quite long-winded mathematical derivations of all this. So this regime is also important if you would like to get a trajectory limit. So if you're a psi-complete guy and you think, oh, we need a trajectory limit, in cases where the Wigner function spreads out, so like for a free particle. Because what does it say? Okay, if I start with a coherent state, then if I don't have the quadratic Hamiltonian, I just have, say, a free particle Hamiltonian. After time t, the coherent state will spread. It will no longer be a coherent state, but I can write it as a superposition of coherent states, right? Actually, the coherent states are an overcomplete basis, so these coefficients aren't quite unique. But anyway, Because the coherent states are pointer states, the environment will quickly decohere this into a mixture of coherent states instead of a superposition. Now, each of the components of this, the centroids of each component, obey Hamilton's equation, but they also spread again, and when they spread, they again decohere into a mixture of coherent states. So basically, what happens is we get a whole bunch of branches, sort of coherent, different coherent state branches of the wave function going off in different directions. And if you track what happens to the mod squared amplitude of these branches, the overwhelming weight of probability will be on paths that are approximately classical trajectories in phase space. So your initial coherent state corresponds to some sort of ensemble of trajectories which start near the same point. And then as the wave function spreads, it decoheres into a mixture of coherent states, and you look at, well, what's the probability of being approximately close to a classical trajectory, and you find that that's high. Okay, so that's basically the story that you want to tell if you're a Psi complete person about what's going on.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Can it happen that when you go to the quantum theory, the phase space is bigger, right, than the classical phase space?
Sure. I mean, we can... I'm talking about a single particle phase space just for simplicity.
Okay.
You can do all this construction on basically an arbitrary phase. An arbitrary phase space that has symplectic structure is fine. But obviously there are some cases which are more tricky than others. But certainly the case of like n classical particles is easy to deal with, and certain field type of situations are easy to deal with as well.
But like in general, when there's decoherence and you have these Schrödinger cat states, do you go back? Your classical trajectories are now in just like the projection of the classical phase space, right?
Okay, so I could take this state and then convert it into a Wigner-Moyle state, into a Wigner function, and it will look like a mixture of coherent states. So it'll look like, this kind of thing. Going back again, all the way back. This kind of thing, except without these interference effects. That's what it'll look like. But if they're spreading as well, then this will sort of evolve into, the spreading will evolve into sort of multiple of these spots, right? So these if these individual spots spread out, then they turn into multiple spots, which again spread out and turn into multiple spots. So you get kind of like a branching. But you look at how much probability is on paths that are close to classical trajectories, and you find that's high. Okay, so that's basically the idea. Okay. There's a couple more things I want to say. I think I can do it in a couple of minutes. Okay. An important special case, however, is chaotic systems. Harmonic oscillator is not a chaotic system. But suppose we have a Hamiltonian that exhibits chaos classically. Then you get trajectories that diverge in phase space exponentially fast. And in that case, your decoherence might not be acting, because this is happening very fast, divergence of trajectories. And decoherence is happening very fast, but decoherence might not be quite quick enough if your Hamiltonian is sufficiently chaotic, if the Lyapunov exponent is large enough. So that won't localize the Wigner function in phase space, and that's a problem if you think you have to have a trajectory limit. However, even classically, you can't really predict the exact trajectory of a chaotic system if you have even a tiny amount of uncertainty, because the trajectories diverge too quickly. Therefore, you could argue that the predictions of Liouville mechanics for minimum uncertainty initial states would be indistinguishable from those of Hamiltonian mechanics in practice. You wouldn't be able to track the trajectory, you wouldn't be able to predict the trajectory. So if you can't do that classically, then we shouldn't expect quantum mechanics to necessarily do it. So most people would say, well, quantum chaos is again its own subject full of controversy, but I would at least say that in this case, it's fine to only have a Liouville limit. Okay, one more thing. how do quantum effects disappear? So I've mostly been talking about getting rid of the negativity of the wave function, of the Wigner function, which is really responsible for interference. But what about all these other quantum effects, right? These effects typically depend on being able to make a choice about measuring different incompatible observables. So I have a choice, you know, in a Bell experiment, Alice chooses to measure in two different non-commuting directions. Okay, but if we think about how we observe a macroscopic system, you typically do so by intercepting just a small fraction of the environment of the system. So there's a bunch of photons, large number of photons scattering off of me, and any one of you in your eyes is intercepting a very small fraction of that. Okay, so the measurements that you can make on me basically boil down to what information can you tell about me from that small fragment of the environment. Okay, so if you consider this scattering state again, suppose you make a quantum measurement on a small subset of these scattered particles, then you could determine what, you could think of that as giving you information about the system. Now, when you looked at the quantum steering question on, I think it was one of the homework questions, you saw how measuring one system could be thought of as an effective measurement on another system. So do that same kind of calculation here, and again, don't have time to do the calculation, but as this n goes to infinity, if k stays finite, you'll find that the measurements that you're doing on the system are all compatible, which means that there's some POVM you could do on the system which would tell you the outcome to all those measurements in one go. So there's no quantum incompatibility. Jurek calls this kind of effect sometimes quantum Darwinism. I don't like the term, but that's what he calls it. So it's basically classical information or classical systems have their information redundantly encoded in the environment. Okay, and in the limit, this means that there's a compatible set of measurements that can be performed, and that's the information about the system that survives. That was basically the last thing I wanted to say. I know this, I've taken a little bit more than the usual time, but to go in through these things in great detail would take a lot longer. So let's summarize. So some systems look classical in the Wigner-Moyell formalism. So Gaussian quantum mechanics has alluvial limit, coherent states, you have a trajectory limit for limited classes. In other cases, you need environmental decoherence. So environmental decoherence can explain why interference disappears. It explains how the Wigner functions become positive. It explains why observables that we can measure become compatible. And it basically gives effective equivalence to an ensemble of trajectories obeying Hamiltonian mechanics, if you want a trajectory limit. However, there's still a big problem with all this. Decoherence, when we talk about decoherence, we're talking about the reduced density operator of the system. The state of the system and the environment, the rest of the universe, is still a pure entangled state evolving unitarily. But it's not clear that I can really interpret these probabilities that occur in the mixture of coefficients as classical probabilities. They're still coming from entanglement with the system. We still have the measurement problem, basically. So for that, we will need to talk about interpretations, and we will do that in the last three lectures, starting with the Bayes-Bohm theory tomorrow. Okay, that's it. Any questions?
How do we know that the state of the universe is pure entangled state?
Well, okay. I'm assuming sort of the Church of the Larger Hilbert space picture here, okay, which sort of says that the Schrödinger equation is everything. Of course, you don't have to agree with that. Yeah.
So you said in the chaotic case, we can kind of recover the trajectory limit from the Liouville?
No, in the chaotic case, you won't see a trajectory limit. Because the point is that even a coherent state with its tiny amount of uncertainty in position and momentum is going to spread so rapidly that decoherence won't have time to localize it. So you'll only get a Liouville limit, but the argument was that even classically, if I can only localize the system in phase space by my observations up to some epsilon, even classically, I won't be able to predict the trajectory, right? So the fact that we can't predict the trajectory in that case doesn't necessarily say that you know, that we you know, even a psi-complete person might be happy to say, you know, we don't need to see individual trajectories in that case, because we can't predict them in any case.
I also wanted to ask, do you know how it's done by bringing forwards and for QFT?
So we can.
Yeah. So there are so part of the problem is that you don't in general have a good symplectic structure always, especially for massless particles. So instead of there being one, there are dozens of proposed. This is the Wigner function for relativistic fields, for instance. So I don't think it's a there are formalisms like that in the literature, but I don't think it's a settled issue which is the right one. So I think it's still kind of open. For the electromagnetic field, like in the quantum optics kind of regime, we use the Wigner function perfectly fine. I mean, in that regime, it's basically, you know, free electromagnetic fields. It's basically analogous to a bunch of harmonic oscillators, and we're fine. But in the general case of relativistic fields, there's still some controversy about how we should define these things. Okay, if there's nothing else, I will see you tomorrow.